Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot.
And today, as I am each month, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Craig Joseph. He is the Chief Medical Officer for Nordic Consulting Partners. Craig, thanks for joining me today.
It is a pleasure, as it is every month.
We normally sort of review the past month of activity. And since we're at the end of 2020, which has been just like every other year, we thought we would actually review the whole of the year versus just last month and take a little bit of a peek into the future. And obviously the major topic that we've had for the majority of the past several months has been COVID-19. First off, any thoughts, anything that, you know, has really stood out to you over the last several months around SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19?
You know, I'm just starting to hear about this thing. Is this that pandemic that you've been talking about?
That's
for a while?
The one.
I don't really pay attention when we do these, so I'm not really sure what you've been saying about it. But, well, we've got some vaccines, a couple. And
isn't that
more
great news? I mean, would you be honest with yourself? Back in January, February, March, whenever you really started paying attention, would you have predicted that we would have vaccines for something that we had never seen or certainly had not seen prior to December of 2019?
Absolutely not. Not only did we not have a vaccine, but we didn't, you know, we're not really have a lot of experience with making vaccines, successfully making vaccines, right, for coronavirus specifically. So, no, it's a monumental task. And a new kind of vaccine, at least new to me, since I am not a vaccine expert, an mRNA vaccine. And that's the reason that they were able to so quickly take research that has been done for decades and put it into the real world with something so quickly.
What it speaks to for 2020, and the thing that stands out for me, is that we've built so much on the shoulders of all the other efforts and work of other people. I mean, your point about messenger RNA vaccines is exactly right. We've not produced them, but we've been working at it, and it all came together at the right time, quite frankly, to allow us to produce a vaccine in record time. I mean, I don't think there's any instance where we've managed to do that at that sort of pace, which it's just incredible to me. And it's a testament to all the people pulling together. And it was all triggered in that instance, triggered by one scientist in China who published the sequence of the virus online so that it was accessible to everybody.
Yep. It's you know, if you would have written a screenplay, I don't think we would have, those in the know would have believed any of it.
And the screenplays that have been written didn't. They absolutely not. They had, what's his name, running around the country in an orange suit and shooting down helicopters and all sorts of things in that classic movie.
Well, we do. We still might need to shoot down helicopters, you know, in order to get the, no, I'm just making that up, trying to come up with some kind of.
To get the vaccine out? You mean?
I don't, since the vaccine's already available, I don't foresee any need for helicopters at this point. It's really just UPS and FedEx trucks.
Right. And UPS and FedEx trucks with special refrigeration, which brings us to the point of the distribution, which has been raising the odd eyebrow or two. How are we doing on that?
We're not doing well. And some epidemiologists are calling out the federal government for really not taking the lead in terms of actually, hey, we've got it. We're going to get it to someone in the state, and then we kind of wash our hands of it. And so every state's left to their own with very, at this point, hardly any money given to them to figure it out. And so it's not been, as of the day we speak today, it's not been very well done. And so my understanding is that about 20 million doses were given out to the states, and about 2 million have been actually put into arms. And so that's a much smaller number. We were kind of expecting 20 million doses to be administered by the end of the year. We're not going to come anywhere close to that. So we do have to figure this thing out. I think the one thing, though, to comment from some of the anti-vaxxers or vaccine naysayers, you know, some of whom will never be convinced. But when you have news stories of physicians almost coming to blows with one another about who gets the vaccine first, I suspect that hopefully the rest of society will see that the doctors are arguing over who can get it. I want it. Do you know anyone that has any on the side?
Yeah, you bring up a couple of interesting points there that, both the sort of resistance, but equally this side or back channel distribution that is causing some resistance from, the ethical considerations. We've seen people trying to jump in front of the line. You're right about, this pushing and shoving. It's interesting. One of the things that I heard, in fact, close to home for me was, the desire by the clinical folks to put it on social media to say I'm receiving it, but actually now not wanting to do so for fear of a backlash because people are judging them and saying, well, why do you have it before I have? So maybe you're right. I mean, we might see a rollout because I heard that one of the suggested levels of herd immunity was cited as high as 90%, which when you think about that and the challenges of getting to that point is going to be very, very significant. So my sort of sense of this is, or at least my hope is, not only that the government steps in, but the people that I really want to step in, because I've seen them do it. I saw them do it at a client of mine, is the military, who go in and they do logistics. They can get things to any point in a location, geography, time, with all of the limitations. And I have to say, that's what I thought was going to happen. Obviously, I was somewhat confused, and we're still struggling. And the fact that there's 18 million doses available and not is just, or actually, no, 19. You said 20 million.
Well, as of this morning, about two, and there's probably a little bit of a lag in the reporting, so that number might be higher. But however, the goal, and I think what was stated as what was going to happen for sure would be 20 million vaccines were going to be in arms by the end of this year, and that's clearly not going to happen, even though those 20 million doses are available. So, yeah, I agree with you. If you want to look to find someone who's good at military precision, it might be the military. I think there are also third parties. So, CVS, Walgreens, some of those groups that can ramp up very quickly and are omnipresent in the United States are set, and have the ability to do that, to give it. I know that some of them are looking to hire thousands of people to actually give immunizations. So we'll get there. I'm pretty confident we'll get there, but it is something that we've been talking about for months and months, that we're going to have these vaccines and we're going to have to get them out. And now we have them, and the actual administration, the thing that we could have been planning for months, doesn't seem that it's as advanced or mature as one would want.
It does bring up one of my little bees that lives in my bonnet occasionally. And that's the requirements to be able to do some of these things. And I agree with you. Most people live within 15 minutes of a pharmacy around the US, even in fairly remote parts. I'm sure that I know there's exceptions to that. But there's a distribution mechanism. But, hiring folks to give vaccines, I can tell you as a qualified physician, I am precluded from doing testing. For a period of time, I was able to volunteer to do testing in my state. So I volunteered, I dressed up in PPE and, was in car parks and in, venues carrying out testing. But they changed the rules, and now you have to be a licensed practitioner to be able to carry out testing. So the idea that you're not a licensed practitioner to be able to give a vaccine here represents a little bit of a challenge that I'm not sure I see a pathway to, unless they start to relax some of these regulations and tap into resources. And do I feel like I could give vaccinations? Yeah, pretty much. I don't know about you. I know you're not practicing clinically, but I feel like you ought to be able to if you needed to, right?
I think I could. And, you know, I think a lot of it, obviously, every state has different rules. And then within the state, different groups interpret the, you know, the rules. When I was in practice, we had medical assistants who gave all of our vaccines. And those are folks who are trained by us. They didn't at that time at least have a license or anything else. And that was okay. But you know,
but
you're absolutely
now. Did you know this? I actually know this. You know, it's one of these surprising areas. There's some reasons why I do. But now you have to go to school, you've got to go to some diploma place and get a diploma. And you can't just take the exam. So you can't just know the knowledge. You have to actually go pay the fee and sit in coursework for a period of time to become a medical assistant.
Yeah, things are different. And I'm not saying necessarily for the better. I agree with you. The other thing is the corporatization of medicine. We can, you know, veer off that way. But, you know, when I practiced with one other physician, and that was it, and we owned the practice, we got to make a lot of rules that physicians now who work for large companies or large groups have have lawyers and regulatory experts and compliance experts that we didn't have. So there was no one to tell us that we couldn't do something. Now, I think we were able to do it, and I'm not saying that we didn't practice safely. Even things that I think are allowed, larger organizations are very risk averse and will tell you no, even though there's no good reason that they're telling you no. So
for those of you just joining, I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and today I'm talking to Dr. Craig Joseph. He is the Chief Medical Officer for Nordic Consulting Partners. We're reviewing 2020. We were just talking about some of the challenges around COVID-19 distribution, looking back and obviously looking forward, hoping logistics get sorted out. And, you know, from a crisis standpoint, perhaps the crisis might remove some of the nuclear arms race of certifications that I personally at least fall foul of as I try to sort of help out and contribute. Perhaps we'll see some of that in 2021. Don't know. Looking at some other things. So COVID-19, obviously, we've learned a lot, and I think it's going to impact us for a long period of time. But there were other things that took place in 2020. Surprise billing. Suddenly there was a focus and new activity. What's your thoughts around that?
Well, so just to kind of clarify, the surprise billing happens when you walk into the emergency department with insurance and then get billed a lot of money, even though the hospital might be in network. Also happens when you have picked out a hospital that's, again, in your network, your insurance company says you can go to the hospital A, and then you get very large bills that are rejected from your surgeon potentially, or from your anesthesiologist or radiologist or pathologist, doctors that you didn't know that you had any interactions with. And they may not be in network. And there was no way for you to know that. And obviously, if it's an emergency, there's no way for you to deal with that. And so people would get these very large bills that would be rejected by their insurance company because the doctors didn't want to take the money that the insurance company was offering. And so now there are people have been complaining about that for a long time, me among them, that it's not fair and there needs to be a middle ground. And so hopefully that's coming. So that was passed recently. At least the initial steps of requiring physicians to come to some agreement with the payers. That's reasonable. Somewhere between what the doctor wants to receive and what the insurance company wants to get. And so I wholeheartedly think it's overdue, and I'm very excited that we're actually making concrete steps towards it. It will make a big difference in people's lives.
Yeah, I think I saw some regulations that were being pushed through around that talked about, you know, if you go, particularly in emergency circumstances, I think that's the one, you know, but it's not confined to that, to be clear. You can still get surprise bills when you think you're in network, but there's this procession of people that show up in your room who, for one reason or another, are not in network. But, you know, in the case of emergency circumstances, you know, you're doing, you make best efforts to do, follow the rules, but somebody falls out of network and you end up with that surprise bill. I mean, that just seems reasonable. And you know, as I think about the sort of reforms around healthcare, one of the things that seems to be a central tenet, and I don't know if this is just 2020, I feel like it's not, it's a lot to do with money and price, you know, and drugs is another one. We've had this huge sort of focus. There was some attempts at trying to create some pricing transparency. I can tell you with 100% certainty that you pay an awful lot more for your drugs in the US than you do in other countries. I've yet to hear a cogent explanation of why that is. Is there anything that you imagine would allow for a difference in pricing that we see?
Well, maybe you're not familiar with our ways. Have you ever heard of lobbyists? That's the reason. That's the answer to your potentially rhetorical question, Dr. Nick. Lobbyists, yeah, sure. So big pharma, which you know, I don't want to say that all pharmaceutical companies are evil. That's absolutely not the case. However, yeah, they're, you know, CMS is not able to do certain things, even though they're a huge purchaser of medications. They're not able to, because the government won't allow them to make demands and require that they pay reasonable amounts of money. And so, you know, you have lobbyists who are saying to Congress people, hey, the reason we need to make all this money is because of our research. And without research and development, which we don't get paid for, we can't, if we don't, you know, get the big money for the few drugs that make it through, then we're not going to be able to continue to do research and development and come up with, now I sound like one of the lobbyists. And hey, you know, you like that mRNA vaccine you got for COVID? Well, come on, we've been working on that for a long, long time, and we've not found any commercial success until now. But the reason we were able to, and there's some truth here, the reason we were able to quickly find that, get that vaccine for COVID out the door in less than a year, was because of all this R&D we had been doing for free.
Yeah. Well, to be clear, nothing is free. Somebody paid for it somewhere and it came.
I'm just saying that drug companies do the R&D. Yeah.
I react to that just because people always call the NHS free. It's not free. It's
no.
Point of service, you know, and things have to be paid for. There is somebody needing to. It's interesting because I was on a webinar recently and, you know, talking about some of these issues. And there was somebody there who said that the most important thing we could do to fix some of these issues was campaign finance reform, which would change the way that some of this lobbyist whole process worked. I don't know. So I'm not a political pundit. I have to say that I continue to be surprised as I learn and understand the US political system. But however we do it, we have to, because it's having such a huge impact. In fact, there was a paper published today, don't know if you saw it, that talked about it, compared the best access to healthcare, and that was defined as people that were in the top 1% or 5% income brackets, living in the best areas, and compared their outcomes, health outcomes, to other countries with, you know, just their regular healthcare. And across the board, even at that level, they're not getting as good healthcare as people around the rest of the world. So even with the discrepancies we have this huge failure to deliver on all of this money that we're paying. So we sure have a big hill to climb to fix that.
Are you saying sometimes our perceptions don't meet reality, that the data show a different picture? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I tend to focus on the data, although I know that's, you know, somewhat heretic in some circles. But
yeah, that's crazy talk.
I know, absolutely. So a couple of other things before we run out of time. I know you have mentioned home hospitals. That's one of the areas of sort of trying to reduce costs, so get people out of hospitals, both from a cost perspective, but also outcomes. I think, you know, they tend to do better and people don't like being in hospitals. Seems like there's some move towards that.
There is, actually. So hospital at home, and there's been research done on this to show that they're quality is about the same, if not maybe even a little bit better. So obviously, we're not talking about taking very, very sick patients and putting them back at home. But for some patients who might be able to be discharged a few days earlier, or patients who could go into a virtual observation unit, that was something that was never paid for by any of the big payers, big insurers. But now, because of the pandemic, and because a lot of hospitals are just filled with patients, they do need to find other ways. And so, the CMS has now started a program by which certain hospitals can apply for and then receive payment, which I believe is the same payment as if the patient were in their walls, but would be at home. Obviously, you've got to have a pretty good IT system. You've got to have a great electronic health record. You've got to have the monitoring systems at home, so you can get the patient to take their blood pressure and their pulse ox to make sure their oxygen is good, do those kinds of things. And also they need to be seen fairly frequently. So at least once a day, someone from the hospital, typically a paramedic or a nurse, goes out and visits with them. So if physically, you meet, what was that?
Physically seen as opposed to virtual. Well,
sometimes physically seen. So it's not just observation, actually. So some hospitals now, they have acute care units that are remote, are at home. And so patients will actually be physically seen every day, not typically by a physician. They'll be overseen by a physician, but yes, a human will go and see them every day and to keep them out of those precious rooms. So not so much about money anymore, but really about just lack of space. You see patients, especially in like Southern California now, they've taken every spot that they can to try to put patients in. And I've seen the gift store. That's when I knew it was bad. The gift store has been repurposed with gurneys now in some hospitals in Los Angeles County. So you need to get these patients out who don't absolutely positively need to be in the hospital. And this is one way. And I think it's going to, once it's, again, as you know, I like to say, don't waste a perfectly good crisis. So we're going to be learning tons. And I think hopefully we won't be able to go back to the days where we make these fairly crazy rules that, well, it's okay if you're physically located over here, but if you're across the street, it's not okay. And so hopefully those will continue to crumble and not be rebuilt unnecessarily in the future.
Wow. So, another benefit of the crisis, as usual, we've run out of time, but I think, in general, 2020 has been a challenging year, but we've learned a lot. We've come a tremendous way. And there's a bunch of changes, and that home hospital to me is quite exciting. I think, most people would say they'd rather not be in hospital. If we can start to deliver and push that out, that's exciting news. And all the progress that we're building on, I agree with you. I think we're going to solve the distribution problem. I just hope we get on and do it as quickly as possible. This is an exciting time. I mean, I'm looking forward to 2021. I think a lot of people have said, good riddance to 2020, but let's celebrate the positive, all of the things that we've learned. So all been a good thing in general.
Yeah, well, I like your optimistic attitude. It's cute. It's cute.
if somewhat foolish, I hear in that subtext there, for sure.
So, I'm with you in hoping 2021 is a better year.
Well, just remains for me to thank you. It's always a great pleasure to connect. Talk about what's going on in healthcare, and look forward to continued episodes in 2021. So thanks again for joining me, Craig.
Thank you. I'll see you next year.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, The Incrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.